This is The Guardian.
I'm Barry Cassidy.
And I'm Tony Barry.
Welcome to Back to Back Barry's, a podcast for Guardian Australia. Well, the search for a ceasefire in the United States-Israel-Iran war goes on, and so does Australia's search for fuel security. But beyond that this week, important policy statements, the government on defence spending, the coalition on immigration. So we'll start there with immigration. It's hardly a detailed policy, not at this stage anyway. It's heavy on observations and generalities and the search for Australian values. Tony, you've spoken already about the potential for this, risks versus rewards, by putting this policy out. It's been out there now for a few days. How are the scales going? Heavier on the risk or heavier on the rewards?
As you know, Barry, every decision you make in politics is a risk versus reward proposition. You've got to look at, you know, what are the rewards for this idea or policy or position statement, and what are the risks? The rewards, we know, immigration, the rate of immigration is the fifth most important issue. At 8% amongst voters, it is their number one issue. And for 27% of voters, it's in their top three. So we know it's important, but it's not nearly the most important. Cost of living is 46%. And housing is, you know, 15 thereabouts. So combined, you know, it's almost two-thirds of the electorate. That's their number one issue. That is where most of the votes are on the table, in my opinion. So it's an important issue for a small segment of the electorate. When we ask who's the best on the rate of immigration to manage that, 40% say One Nation, 19% say Labor, and just 14% say the Coalition. So they're coming third by a long way. So they don't have a lot of equity in this area. They're the sort of potential rewards. The risks, in my view, are, I think they actually have put too much detail on this policy, is my view. The stuff about liberal democracies, identifying people from who don't come from liberal democracies are less welcome, I think is a big issue. But more importantly, they are giving Labor an opportunity, or Labor's surrogates or proxies, to run subterranean campaigns, might be misinformation, might be scare campaigns, into some of these communities. You know,
well, they might just repeat back what Angus Taylor has already said. It might be just that simple.
Yeah, well, they could just sort of say, and it would be not true, but they could say, if your mum doesn't speak English, she'll be deported. Now, if you're not plugged into the mainstream media architecture, which most Australians aren't these days, in the absence of any alternative information, that's an entirely believable concept. So, you know, you just need to look back at when Jane Hume made those comments about Chinese spies during the election campaign, and Labor's surrogates had it out on WeChat and other platforms almost instantly. And, you know, that was considered to be responsible for a big swing in seats like Menzies and Bennelong, where there's a big Chinese population.
Well, can I give you one example of what they might say too, is that Angus Taylor says that you, the migrants, you're a drain on society. He used the term, he used it selectively, of course, as some are, but nevertheless, a drain on society. Now, you see how that goes over in some of these places, that you might be a recent immigrant, you had a job, you became redundant, as so many people do, you're suddenly unemployed, and you feel, talking about me, it might be somebody who started a small business, 11 interest rates rises, and the business goes bust, suddenly you're a drain on society. They're no different to anybody else, and yet they've been singled out as a drain on society. There would be people all over the country feeling that when they hear it, feeling that they're talking about me.
Yeah. Don't forget, though, in the polling we've done when we've tested that proposition, and we spoke about this once before, I said I was certain it was authored by Tony Abbott, under Labor, immigration numbers are too high and standards are too low. 64% agree with that, just 14% disagreed. So I think they've taken that result, but then they've put in all this detail, which gives a bit of a bullseye to hit. It's more than a bullseye. It's like wearing a high-vis vest and a bullseye with some of these more details. I think I actually just would have left it more that value proposition, which they know that 64% of Australians will give a head nod to.
Just to where you opened up to on the fact that it's not a top-of-mind issue, but it's there and it's important. But you compare the immigration issue in Australia with comparable countries, like in the United States, for example. It's a huge issue. It's a huge issue because somewhere between 11 million and 14 million people in America are there illegally. And that's been the case for a long time. Economically, they rely on it. They need the jobs and so on. But they are enormous numbers. Even in the UK, something like 40,000 people, illegal immigrants, cross the channel in small boats. They may have genuine claims to refugee status, but 40,000 arrive every year. We don't have that. What we have are 70,000 or so people who overstay their visas. And historically, governments just work their way through those numbers.
Yeah.
I guess my question is, who are they trying to impress by this then, if it's not such a top-of-mind issue? When you say that One Nation supports it, is that what they're essentially trying to do here, is to bring back some of the One Nation support?
I think it's actually a bit of a strategy to come second. So at the moment, One Nation's coming second, around mid-20s, high-20s, and the coalition are sort of high-teens, you know, 20, thereabouts in most polls. It feels to me it's not a strategy to win. It's a strategy to get over the top of One Nation, at least. I don't think there's a lot of votes in it. I think there's some net votes in it, but you've got to have a primary. The coalition has to have a primary vote of really 40%, you know, or the high 30s, ideally 45%. But if it was strong preference flow from One Nation, you know, high 30s might be enough. Well, you know, they're at 19, 20. So, look, there's probably a few votes in this for them on a net basis, but, you know, can you out Hanson Hanson? That's a marginal debate. So, yeah, I'm not really sure why they've tapped into those sort of specifics when the biggest opportunity for the coalition is on the economy. And you know, the challenges that Albanese is probably going to face coming up on that.
Yeah, absolutely. But one aspect of it that I think is a problem for them because of the way that it was presented, and that is checking social media at airports.
Hmm.
And the media already has been describing this as Trump-like, that it's an ICE-like measure. I think that's dangerous territory because we've already talked about how toxic Trump is. We saw it in the last election campaign. There had to be a major influence there because Trump ran through everything and I think disadvantaged Peter Dutton, partly his own fault, through the last election campaign. So this kind of idea that suddenly it becomes this sort of heavy-handed law enforcement checking social media at the airports, that's what we fear about America at the moment, is turning people off going there. I think that one is a real problem.
Yeah, well, the Joint Agency Task Force, which, you know, it has connotations of ICE and it can be characterised that way by opponents to this idea and, you know, whether it be through some of those, you know, peer-to-peer platform communication measures or other social media ecosystems, algorithms and so forth, you know, that sort of information can be put out there, which will spook people. And that Trumpian language, you know, James Patterson this week also talked about how Albanese needs to make peace with Trump. Trump is radioactive in Australia. Yeah, he is box office poison. On our last poll for the Fin Review, he is net minus 55. 70% have an unfavourable impression of him. Just 15% have a favourable impression of him. That is hugely toxic. You know, amongst women, he's 88% unfavourable, just 6% favourable. You know, in the inner, middle and outer suburbs, it's all in the high net minus 50s.
And, you know, like to say make peace with him, it's moved beyond that now because of those sort of attitudes that people have and views they have of Donald Trump. It's no longer a case where somebody who is so disliked by the electorate that you get to a position where you want to make friends. That's appeasement now because he's pretty much lost the rest of the world, just as Netanyahu has, I think, for Israel. But Trump in particular, in the way that he's isolated so many countries around the world, why would we want to buck the trend and work hard on being a friend?
And 68 million Catholics in America.
Yeah, well, he's made matters worse by all of that. I noticed for the benefit of those who are watching this on YouTube, President Nixon now more than ever is what the T-shirt says. Then we're not picking that up on audio.
But
what's the message there? Is it that Donald Trump is worse than President Nixon ever was?
Well, I think on foreign affairs, you'd happily have Nixon back in the White House. But but it is the 50th anniversary today of the screening of All the President's Men, one of the great classic movies.
Right. Well, just look at some of the reaction that we've had to the immigration policy announcement. Paul Keating, obviously, you know, predictably, but it's come out hard on it. What I did agree with him on was the Pauline Hanson approach of the monoculture. Australia, a country of 25 million people, she seems to think can just close its doors to any influences from the rest of the world. We don't need multiculturalism. Our culture is fine as it is, thanks very much. I just see that that's such an absurd position to take when the world has so much to offer. But more importantly, I think more relevantly, Amanda Vanstone, who was Immigration Minister in a coalition government for 3 or 4 years, and she worries about the potential for heavy-handed law enforcement, and she thinks that this policy puts Australia's reputation, global reputation, as a multiculturalism that we've succeeded in that era, it puts that at risk. We are a migrant nation, she says. Immigration is not a law enforcement portfolio. That wouldn't have been helpful to Angus Taylor to have her speak out in the way that she has.
Yeah, I mean, Angus, Amanda is always a very strong communicator, and she was a former immigration minister back when I think the Howard government used to articulate the benefits of immigration. If I had one complaint about the government on this policy, is I think they failed manifestly to communicate the benefits of a skilled immigration program, why it's beneficial to Australia, bringing in skills, whether it be, you know, in the healthcare sector, for example, pathology, specialists, medical health and so forth, nurses. These are all really important functions. And, you know, I do look back at George W. Bush. I was watching a couple of YouTube videos of him, you know, as you do on a weekend, and he was talking about immigration and the importance of it, and how it nourishes the soul of the country and how it rejuvenates the soul, and how immigrants perform jobs that Americans won't do or can't do, you know, highly skilled and specialist jobs. And I look at, you know, where the White House is now, but also where, you know, the Australian Conservative side is as well, you know, where they're just basically taking strategy from Sky After Dark and Fox News, effectively.
Yeah, and the difference this time around, too, is that even though it was an indirect reference, and you've already spoken about this, but he kind of implied that this non-discriminatory policy is at risk, because he's talking about not just that certain individuals are not suitable, but certain countries are not suitable as a source of immigration. And he talked about countries that have dictatorships and authoritarian control and so on, missing the point, of course, that that's precisely why so many of these people want to go and live in a free country like Australia, because they don't want to bring they didn't create the societies that they live in, and they don't want to bring those sorts of influences to Australia. They want the system that operates here.
Yeah, and one of those countries, of course, is China. And Chinese immigrants will soon overtake the number of immigrants from the United Kingdom, and they populate all around the country and make great contributions, but they're in electorates like Deakin, Menzies, Bennelong, and so forth.
And on values anyway, I mean, these sort of Australian values, and you get the colloquial terms all the time, you know, about, you know, a fair go, where that's what we're about, and so on. Are there really Australian values anyway, or the kind of values that they come up with are values that most countries in the world embrace? I don't think there's anything particularly unique about our values. And we also have in place a We already have a test, a character test, and I just can't see, well, certainly not to this point, I don't think the coalition has explained what is missing from that character test that would help in terms of bringing to Australia people with sounder, more Australian-like values. At some point, they're going to have to be far more specific about that, and what precisely are they talking about?
Yeah, they said that it's non-binding, the current one. And they proposed to make it binding, so therefore the government or agency could take action against you if they find evidence that you don't meet that criteria or the Australian values per se. But again, I think it's a classic example where detail is not your friend in politics. It usually is. But in this particular case, if they had left at that top level statement, that values proposition, which, as I said, 64% of Australians agreed with, which is a very strong set of numbers. But instead, they've kind of got it bogged down into this detail. It's just a classic example of playing to internal audiences. I think this is the thing where, You know, they sort of think, well, this will play out well amongst our branch members, amongst Sky After Dark, and not really thinking through the consequences. And I think, again, you know, this opportunity that Labor or their proxies have got to run scare campaigns or truth campaigns, subterranean ones through various social media ecosystems. I just feel that Liberal Party for about 10, 15 years now, they don't think through what will our opponents do. You know, they don't anticipate where's the problems here. You know, the nuclear power plant policy that they put forward last time. They just don't really think through where is this going to go, what will they do, how do we cover that off. And I think it's primarily because in the last 10, 15 years they've been so focused on internal audiences and promotion internally that they don't sort of look at what are the opponents doing. I think if you go back to Howard, I mean, Howard learnt from his mistakes. You were there when, you know, he used to, what would a news poll have him at?
14% or something.
Yeah, why does he bother?
Yeah.
But I think he was a student of politics and learnt from his mistakes and was constantly thinking about his opponents and what they'll do and how do I cover that off. And Labor, I think, they know what their weaknesses are, and so they're better prepared. I think the Liberal Party lately, they're oblivious to what their weakness is. And the greatest weakness in politics is to not understand your weakness.
Yeah. I understand why they're raising the character test. And you want a system that works. You want a system that would prevent some of these hate preachers from getting out here in the first place, so that you then don't have the difficulty of deporting them. But it's got to be a sound policy. It's got to work. And so far, I just think the detail is missing on that. You know, in the United States, just in the last little bit, under the ICE arrangements, they deported the guy who set up Latinos for Trump. And he couldn't have been more supportive. And they booted him back to El Salvador after spending about 9 months in jail.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's... that's how a regime can work.
I'm already fascinated, though. The American midterm is going to be fascinating because Trump's numbers are losing altitude. His base is fragmenting and fracturing. On my, as you know, my new segment every week, Barry, is Tucker Carlson's wisdom of the week. And Tucker Carlson said this week that he feels sorry for Trump. He feels sorry for all slaves, relating to his relationship with Bibi Netanyahu. And, you know, I think his tweet where he depicted himself as a doctor dressed like Jesus, he deleted. I don't recall that he's ever deleted anything in his career. I thought it was significant. I mean, it's rare for this guy. It wasn't an admission. It was obviously the media's fault for interpreting it as Jesus.
Obviously. I've been to see lots of doctors, and occasionally you see them dressed like Jesus Christ. Yeah, it's a common thing.
And that was his line. But that's as big as a concession of a mistake as you get from that guy.
Yeah. Somebody's got to him and said to you, just, you know, can you appreciate what you've just done? You've taken, started a war with the Catholic Church. But J.D. Vance is a Catholic. And I just wonder whether there's an element here of Donald Trump just making life uncomfortable for him.
Yeah.
He knows that J.D. Vance is in the wings. He wants the nomination next time around. And it was uncomfortable for him. First of all, he had to support the war in Iran. There's evidence that he didn't.
Yeah.
And now he's got to defend Donald Trump against the Pope.
Yeah, there was a very well-briefed piece to the New York Times saying that J.D. Vance was opposing it, and he was the only one in the room that was opposing it, which Trump will know exactly where that came from. But that's obviously J.D. Vance recognising this is going to be hugely unpopular. He is a war veteran himself. He knows a bit about this subject. And he realises it's hugely unpopular, and if he wants to ever be president, he needs to put some distance between this conflict and himself.
I just want to pick up another issue by way of an email. James Thompson emailed and was a generous opening where he said it's the best political commentary going around. Thank you, James. But he wrote that he missed the Save Easter, and he was hoping that in that program we would touch on gambling advertising, which adjusted the new policy had just been announced. Two parts to this. I'll ask you the first part. Any polling yet, he asked, to gauge responses to that? Has there been? I don't know whether you've been in the field on that issue specifically. Have you?
No, but we have done a lot of research, and it's something that's come up really a lot post-COVID. This sense from the electorate, and I think it explains in part, in a small part, the rise of One Nation, is this sense governments don't trust me. so I don't trust the government. You know, the distrust of institutions, whether it be corporate and business, government or media, is more pervasive than I've ever seen in 30 years of research. And I think Albanese anticipated that. Obviously, their research telling them the same thing in Labor. And so they're very careful not to be sort of too nanny state in that regards. And he's not a risk taker, Albanese. He's a pretty cautious sort of fellow. And I think underpinning it in the background for all this is him and Jim Chalmers know we are heading in for some really rough times financially. We were prior to the conflict, and that's now turbocharged even more. And we've spoken before about how in the 1990 election, the 93 election, and the 2025 election, the incumbent government won despite bad economic conditions and data. But Albanese is smart enough to know that, you know, that's it's not a lay down as air.
Yeah, James went on to say, and you've covered this in a sense, but will this issue get some attention, or will the government get away with what he calls a mediocre response? If you just look at some of the initiatives that he announced, that and it won't start until January next year, but capping the advertisements, gambling advertisements, 3 an hour before 8:30, so they're still going to be out there. There won't be any during school drop-offs and school pickups. I don't know how many of those cars are tuned into radio stations that are running gambling ads in any case. But it's kind of not getting there. You know, it doesn't end this exposure that kids have generally to gambling advertising. There is no need for it. We don't have it for cigarettes, for example. And it's so, why is it there? And why are they so reluctant to put a more widespread ban, even a total ban on gambling ads? Because you do hear it all the time that kids interpret football, they talk about football, they recite outcomes and prospects according to the odds and the game's forecast. They are impacted by it.
But I mean, culturally, we love our sports. It is part of the ritual of sports for some people, younger people in particular, socially, whether it be out at pubs, sort of following footy games on the TV and having a bet with their mates.
And they're welcome to do that, but do they need advertising constantly in their ear to encourage them to do
that? But I think from a public policy point of view, and I don't gamble, from a public policy point of view, you then get into this situation of like, well, do we start banning fast food ads? Do we start banning alcohol ads and so forth?
Well, we have. We've already gone down that track.
Limited.
Cigarettes, for example.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a no-brainer. I think tobacco, everybody agrees that that's a quirk in history, that tobacco, if tobacco was discovered today, there is no way that any government would allow its sale. It's a historical thing, and smoking numbers are falling. But those other sort of products don't kill you, and so therefore I think the government needs to be careful. And I think Albanese recognised that.
Gambling, by the way, does kill people. It has killed a lot of people.
Yeah, I think, you know, we could say that about fast food and alcohol as well.
Yeah,
so
sure.
Where do you draw that line?
Ross Gittins recently wrote that Anthony Albanese acts only when pressure from within his own ranks grows to intolerable levels. And when he does act, you get the bare minimum, essentially, you know, to try and make the issue go away. You know, I think it might apply to this issue. But it does bring it, I think, this topic to a broader issue about, and your partner, Cos Samaras, wrote about it this week, but talks about the younger generation and those coming on to the electoral rolls and voting for the first time. And that's becoming, will be the biggest group. Mm. It'll have a real impact. And Labor's almost smug about the fact that, well, they're ours and we have the great majority of them. And I don't think that's something that they can assume for very much longer. No. Because these people, the younger people, identify politics, and Cos talked about this, but that the political parties are transactional. They manage things. They manage issues as they arise. They put together a budget that manages rather than reforms. They don't tackle the kind of issues, though this budget might, but we'll see to what extent, things like the inequities in the tax system for young people, the housing and climate change, and the free ride for minors, and all those kind of issues. But the difference is with this generation is I don't think they're idealistic. I think they're passionate, and I think they have convictions. And that's what they don't recognise in the major parties. They don't reflect their compassion, for a start, but their convictions. And when you look at the mayor of New York, you look at who reflected Bernie Sanders in a way and drew all of those supporters from the Bernie Sanders troop, that wasn't idealistic. That was recognising there's a group that share those kind of attitudes.
Yeah. We've noticed in a lot of our research, there's two defining aspects of younger voters. One is they live in their own social media ecosystems and algorithms. And so for any major party to punch into that algorithm and get seen is incredibly difficult. The second defining feature of that generation is very tactical voting. So they follow politics enough to know the outcome they want. And it might be, we want a Labor Prime Minister to tackle climate change, but we don't think they'll be motivated unless we vote for the Greens to give them a kick up the pants. And so they'll deliberately vote Greens, but the outcome they want is a Labor Prime Minister or a Labor Premier. So they do think about their voting and how to deploy their vote tactically. And that makes them sort of, I wouldn't say you can rent their vote, but it certainly makes it difficult for major parties to hold that vote. And, you know, I've seen it before when Labor starts getting a bit cocky about their position because of the very weakened opposition that they're facing, that sort of confidence and cockiness, it can come back to haunt you. And, you know, when Howard dispatched of Latham in 2004, Howard had got rid of Beazley twice, who was a very decent and capable fellow, and Simon Crean, who, again, similarly, Latham, less so, but very unorthodox and brilliant in his own way, not forgetting that he was Gough Whitlam's, you know, apprentice. We all sort of thought, well, Howard is unbeatable. You know, he's a genius. And then, of course, this guy from Queensland comes along and just pantses him.
Yeah. And I think part of it, too, is in the minds of the younger people is the way that politicians conducted, even within a party with the dominance that Labor has in the parliament at the moment, that they don't vigorously debate anything internally anymore, and therefore they get this sense that there is no passion, there is no commitment. I'm not suggesting you go back to the days when they had their conferences and they would have all these issues fought out on the floor and they'd be shouting and yelling at one another and you'd have demonstrations on uranium mining, you know, outside. And it has to be a little more controlled than that. But the discipline that exists now, they all toe the line no matter what, even on the support for the war in Iran. When, you know, the support for the war in Iran would be probably running at 20% in Australia, and yet they all stick to that line. They do learn the political skills, they learn how to operate internally, but they seem to be losing this connect with the audience.
Yeah.
Will from California as well kind of weighs in on this in a way where he says there's a tendency to conflate populism with popular. And he talks about Mamdani, the mayor of New York, who he says is not a populist. He has a track record as a democratic socialist, and he's the real deal, he says, like Bernie Sanders when he built this coalition within the left. There is a distinction, isn't there, between what is popular and what is populism, or is populism just exploiting the popular?
Yeah. No, I read that email. It was interesting. I mean, I still stick to my position that Mamdani's a populist. Yeah, he's highly charismatic and he's quite compelling when you watch him. It's hard to sort of keep on scrolling past, mostly because I intensely disagree with most of the things that he's saying. But yeah, I think that's a valid contribution that Will has made, but I'll stick to my position, I think.
We'll take a break and then we'll come back and have a look, among other things, at the government's defence policy or defence spending announcement.